The Dalai Lama once said that today, more than ever before, life must be characterized by a sense of universal responsibility, not only nation to nation and human to human, but also human to other forms of life. Join me in conversation with some of the world's most creative thinkers to explore the importance of ethics to this responsible decision-making in today's technologically infused world. Artists, entrepreneurs, scientists, journalists, academics, and beyond navigate the gray, the blend of right and wrong, of opportunities and risks on all sides of our most important challenges, whether gene editing, civilian space travel, or artificial intelligence. They also probe the age-old and more ethically black and white behaviors, such as sexual misconduct, human trafficking, and life-threatening inequality. Our guests endeavor to transcend religious, political, national, and ethnic perspectives, but recognize the inevitable biases we all bring. The term ethics can make us uncomfortable. At the Ethics Incubator, we confront the E-word head-on. It may be inconvenient or even unclear, but ethical conundrums underpin almost every headline and affect almost every human choice. With truth under threat and the boundaries of humanity blurring, I believe that ethical decision-making tethers us to our humanity. As always, we welcome your thoughts. Welcome to Chip Connolly, who is joining us today on the Ethics Incubator. As you all have been hearing, I'm focusing quite a bit on ethics and well-being, or ethics and a life well-lived. And Chip, It's really a pleasure and an honor to meet you. I discovered your Modern Elder Academy a bit by chance and all of your wonderful books. But before we get there, if you wouldn't mind, just sort of take us back a little bit. You've had quite a number of amazing career steps. But how did you sort of get to where you are and to the point that you wanted to found something called the Modern Elder Academy?
First of all, it's an honor to be here. Thank you. My trajectory has led me to where I am today, and it really feels like it's the culmination or the crescendo of all of what was there before me. I went to college and graduate school at Stanford University in the San Francisco Bay Area. I started a boutique hotel company called Joie de Vivre in San Francisco when I was 26 years old. And over the next 24 years was the founder and CEO of that company that grew to 52 hotels around California. And it was the second largest boutique hotel company in the US. I sold it. I had a very rough age 45 to 50 for a lot of reasons, which we can go into if you want. And I got to the other side of it, and at 50, no longer had that business that I thought I would be operating and running for till I was 80. So I didn't know what was next, but I did know that, like, wow, midlife is a confusing time. And so I ended up a couple years later being asked by the three founders of Airbnb, when it was a tiny little startup, to join them to become their in-house mentor and really sort of help run the company with them. And I did that. I did that for 7.5 years, 4 years full-time, 3.5 years part-time. During that time, they called me the Modern Elder. I didn't like that a lot, but what they meant by that was, like, you are like this, they said a Modern Elder is someone who's as curious as they are wise. So it's like this alchemy of curiosity and wisdom. And I liked that. I did like that. And
I said, like that too, very much.
Yeah. If you want to call me a Modern Elder, and that's fine, as long as it's that definition. And so, it was a fascinating journey. You know, by the end of my time there, Airbnb had become the most valuable hospitality company in the world and was a public company. And my mentee, Brian, who's the CEO and co-founder, was a public market, you know, CEO at a young age. And so I'm just really proud of that experience, even though, you know, in its own way, Airbnb is a controversial company. And I did my best to try to, you know, add some ethics. Good news is it was the leadership team and the founders really they're good people. And so it helped, you know, it was different. I did everything I could to make sure that we were not Uber. Everybody used to, when I joined Airbnb, it was like Uber and Airbnb, the sharing economy darlings. It's like, we don't want to be in the same sentence as Uber.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, because in my book, The Power of Ethics, I use Airbnb as an example of the positive.
Yeah,
Not
exactly.
that they were perfect, but that they were
No.
very reactive when something went wrong, and they learned lessons, and then they sort of grabbed the bull by the horns and really took
Yeah.
leadership relative to a lot of other companies.
Agreed. And I'm proud, I'm proud of, my time there. Toward the end of my time there, full time, I came down here to Mexico, where I had a home on the beach in Baja, which is Baja California Sur, which is a part of Mexico. And I started writing a book, my fifth book, which was called Wisdom at Work: The Making of a Modern Elder. And while I was writing that book, I had a Baja aha. I had an epiphany. And the Baja aha is like, why don't we have midlife wisdom schools, a place where people in the middle of their adult life can come and reimagine and repurpose themselves, whether it's personally, professionally, spiritually, physically, whatever it is. And that's how MEA, the Modern Elder Academy, came to be 6 years ago. We've had 4,000 alumni from 44 countries that have come here, and we have 26 regional chapters around the world. And we have a second campus opening in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we even have a residential community, a regenerative community. So it's been a fascinating journey, and I have a new book coming out called Learning to Love Midlife that really sort of talks about what I've learned in the last 6 years.
Well, it is a fascinating journey, and in particular, just to go back to the beginning, founding a company when we were 26, there weren't very many people founding companies, much less hotel companies like that. There was starting to be sort of the odd tech company, but that it's absolutely a fascinating journey. Can you tell us a little bit about, you mentioned a decade that was very difficult for you between, if I'm correct, 40 to 50. Would you mind sharing a little bit about what
Yeah.
that's about?
First half of that decade was great. The second half was awful. And some of it was circumstantial. So in the second half of the decade, we had the Great Recession, and I was running a boutique hotel company with restaurants and spas, and that the recession really was punishing. But that wasn't all. I mean, I had a long-term relationship ending and against my will, against my desire, and that was hard. I had a foster son, an African American foster son who was going to prison wrongfully, and I was trying to get him out. Yeah, it was a lot. And then I had five male friends commit suicide during that period as well. But what was really hard was I had outgrown my identity. So my identity was to be the founder and CEO of Joie de Vivre, this boutique hotel company. And I was an admiration addict. I wanted you to love me because of my accomplishments. But what used to have value for me no longer had value. It's like somehow like the helium balloon had lost its air, and it was falling. And I also had a allergic reaction to an antibiotic that led me to having a flatline experience. So I died 9 times in 90 minutes, and that was a wake-up call for the hotelier. And I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to really spend my time writing and speaking. So it was a lot going on, and I thank God I had my best friend was a leadership coach and a personal coach, and she really held my hand through that very difficult time. And then I got into my 50s, and my 50s have been my best decade, my favorite decade of my life. And I'm now 63 as of yesterday. So I'm really curious about the idea that, wow, maybe the best years are ahead of me. And the U curve of happiness research actually shows that. It shows that like at age 50, we actually start getting happier again. After 45 to 50 is the low point for happiness.
That's quite a number of concurrent difficulties. So clearly you have a lot of resilience, and that's something that I've been working a lot on is resilience. Do you think that you've substituted one identity for another? Did you substitute the entrepreneur? For the entrepreneur, did you substitute writer, speaker, founder of MEA? Is that, or are you beyond kind of identity that's linked to accomplishment, that's linked to external production of whether it's books or a P&L or an institution?
Yeah, no, I love your question, Susan. I would say that what's underlying, it's really important to look at what's underlying the identity or the archetype. And the archetype that has defined me much of my life, which is the hero, man, is that still attached to me like a band-aid? The good news is I am very aware of it, and I'm looking at all the ways that I am pulling the band-aid off. But I think on the identity side, I, you know, both Carl Jung and Richard Rohr, the famous Christian mystic, have said the same thing, which is that it's around midlife that the primary operating system in our life moves from our ego to our soul. But no one gives you operating instructions for the new operating system. So the way I look at it is it's like it's a dance. And our life is a dance between the ego and the soul. And for the first half of our adult life and first half of our life, the ego is the is leading the dance. So I'm going to use very, you know, in the era we live in, it's, it, this is risky, but I'm going to use very traditional gender perspective here. Right. The ego is the man, the soul is the woman. And the ego is leading the dance, as is typically the case in traditional male-female ballroom dancing. And it's around midlife that actually there's a shift. And the soul now is leading the dance. It's not that the ego has gone away. The ego is still there, but the ego is not in charge as much. Yes, it's an awkward dance and you're stepping on each other's feet. But with time, you get into this new rhythm. And the new rhythm is, for me, is one where, yes, I have the hero archetype ground, but when it comes to my identity, I no longer define myself by my accomplishments. I believe in Eric Erickson's, you know, suggestion in midlife that it's generativity versus stagnation. And the most important thing to consider after age 50 is I am what survives me. So I am here to serve, and I am what survives me is a very different place than being the very heady, ambitious, ego-filled CEO who wants to get my photo on the front page of the local newspaper.
So it's interesting because hearing you, it strikes me that this is what happens, and Richard Rohr is extraordinary, and he always has an extraordinary way of explaining things. But it strikes me that when someone is healthy, that's what happens. They let go of the ego a little bit, and even if it is sort of an awkward dance, they're not the 75-year-old hedge fund manager. You know, they let go of whatever it was that they were doing, and they give somebody else an opportunity, and they look to contribute. And it strikes me that that's what's healthy. And so I'm really looking forward to your book about midlife crisis. And I'm kind of wondering if in it, you know, the people who hang on, who are 60, who want to believe they're 40, sort of how that goes. But let me ask you a slightly different question, just to drill down a little bit into some of your content. You've talked a lot about purpose and finding purpose. Can you talk a little bit about why purpose is important and what it is and how we find it?
When it comes to purpose in the United States, it's a bit of a performance anxiety creator, because there's almost a sense like, oh, it's a possession. You know, purpose is a very personal thing, and it is not, it's not meant to be a possession, like something you left at the restaurant, you know, at the end of the night accidentally. Instead, it's an action. So it's a verb. So to be purposeful is what brings you the breadcrumbs that takes you to your purpose. So when someone says to me, oh, I don't feel like I have a purpose, my question to them is usually, what agitates you? What excites you? What makes you curious? And or when you were younger and you had time and space to be curious and time and space to try things, what did you love doing that you don't tend to do anymore? And those kinds of questions, as was true recently with a litigation attorney who was here at MEA at our Baja campus, she was like, she hated it. She hated what she was doing. She was your age. She was like 60 years old. She was like, I don't like this. I'm not enjoying this. I don't like the person that's making me become. It's like, okay, well, let's do the research. I'm like, you know, but I don't have a purpose. It's like, okay. And it turns out when she was a teenager, she loved baking pies with her grandmother. And that woman now is going to be retiring from being a litigation attorney and becoming a pastry chef and going to pastry school, and she's going to create a bakery.
Fantastic.
That is the kind of thing that we help people with. It's not always that simple. And you have to go under a bunch of layers sometimes, and you have a lot of other practical concerns like, oh, I need to make money, and I worry about how people will see me, and you know, and I'm not very talented at that thing, or I'm incredibly agitated about that. I don't think I could pour my life into that purposeful thing,
right?
Because it's going to just get me pissed off.
It's like, right. Okay. Well, so it's very interesting what you say. And I'd like to ask you a little bit about the relationship between purpose and sort of our true north from an ethical point of view, and what somebody's call them principles, call them values. Different people use different words, but sort of how we, I really focus on how we make decisions, whether it's the CEO of Airbnb, or whether it's President Biden, or whether it's just, you know, us in our individual lives. But what strikes me from, I teach a couple of classes at Stanford every spring. One of them is called Ethics on the Edge. And it's a great, it's great fun because there are students from all over the university. It's not in a particular department. And one of the things that I'm seeing now is this sense of pressure on purpose or something like it, even if the students are not calling it purpose, at a very young age. And the way it's coming out is that they think they need to find it in the jobs that they find. So, you know, they really want to work at Facebook because they think it's fun and they'll make a lot of money, but they feel that in some of them genuinely want to go to an NGO or genuinely want to go to a company that is truly sort of ESG focused or environmental sustainability governance, but and social, but a lot of them, it's just sort of, you know, I want to show that I have a purpose, but I don't know what it is. And I'll have to say to them, but you're 20 years old. And right now, you know, your purpose is to just kind of live life, ask questions. But can you reflect a little bit on the relationship between one purpose and sort of true north, and in particular at this middle age that MEA focuses on?
So there's a big P purpose and there's a small P purpose. And knowing the difference between the two is important, because you can have multiple big P purposes, multiple small P purposes. A small P is like, it can be something that feels inconsequential to you, but it's important, you know? So you're 20 years old and your small P purpose, or your, it could even be your big P purpose, is getting an education, you know, becoming one of, you know, the one of the world's leading experts at your age on whatever topic it is. Your small P purpose could be taking care of your ailing parents. Your small P purpose could be, so these, the values are what defines whether it's a big P or a small P purpose. Your values help you to determine, like for some people, like taking care of your parents in the last 5 years of their life is a big P purpose for someone. For someone else, it might be a small P purpose. And for someone else, it might not be a purpose at all. It might be an obligation that they just, excuse me, hate. I was going to say fucking hate, but yeah, they just don't like it.
You can say that, but, and what about you? I mean, what about your, if you had to sort of talk about your true north, or live your life by, what would those be?
So my true north is absolutely at this stage of my life, helping people to see that midlife is a chrysalis, not a crisis. It is a time for transformation. And I feel that way partly because I had suicide ideation between 45 and 50, and I lost 5 friends to suicide during that time, all of them men too. So long story short is that is what fuels me. It's a big P purpose for sure. I have small P purposes as well, but that's the one that actually is overriding. And that's the difference in some ways between a big P and a small P purpose. A big P purpose is something that is, you feel like you've been put on earth to do, or you feel that you have a unique history that has taken you to this place for this. And that's why it's different than a small P purpose.
When you mention your values, so what are your core values? What are some examples of some of your core values?
Definitely justice and fairness. I mean, a feeling of, you know, I went to junior high school and high school in the inner city of LA. So I was a curious white boy because I was a white kid in a predominantly non-white school. And I mean, at a young age, I got very clear about what that meant in terms of like justice. I'm a gay man and I came out at age 22 in 1983 at the height of the AIDS fears. And that was a very hard thing to do. And I was, you know, at age 26, a CEO and a gay CEO. Like how often is that the case?
So I was a Stanford undergraduate also. And I remember at that time, that was around the time that AIDS came out and was a big deal, particularly in the San Francisco Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And two of my best friends were gay. And one of them died of AIDS right after our wedding. But it was a very confusing time. And I remember when I got, you know, when I got to law school, and I started thinking about this during COVID, when I got to law school at Columbia, our constitutional law final question, which was a brilliant question at the time because there was no answer, was basically, should the United States Immigration Service test foreigners coming into the country for HIV?
Yeah.
And that was a constitutional law question. So it was a really tricky time. And it's and that really resonates for me because I was it was from a very different perspective, sort of in the thick of it then. What about sort of what's going on in the world around us? What there are sort of myriad social justice crises around the world mm-hmm. and myriad ethical failings and dramas. What particularly sort of gets to you, for lack of a better way to put it? What particularly troubles you if you had to pluck from the headlines?
When the underrepresented group is being demonized or is not being given the opportunities that the dominant demographic is being given, that will always frustrate me, and I will always try to figure out, okay, how do we solve for that? So I would say that's probably the number one for me, and it's part of the reason I had a African-American foster son. It's part of the reason I have been so actively involved in nonprofits that are doing social justice work.
I'd like to focus for a minute on well-being and start with mm-hmm. how do you define well-being? How do you help people further well-being? And what's the relationship for you between well-being and a good sense of a true north or a sense of values?
I think you said earlier, a life well-lived is a form of well-being. When a person feels that they are consciously curating their life on the physical, the emotional, the relational, the psychological, the intellectual, spiritual levels in such a way that you feel content. Happiness is the playing field of young people and young adults. Contentment is the playing field for people over 50. And so for me at age 63, well-being is to feel content across those various spectrums of my life. If you look at well-being, it's to be well. And I think we tend to get a little too focused on the physical side of this. It's interesting that the word illness starts with the letter I, and the word wellness starts with the letters we. Mm-hmm. And so social wellness is something that I'm really focused on. It's something we at MEA very much focus on, because in many ways in the United States, the way we tend to think of wellness is and well-being is as a personal individual endeavor. And you know, I think that there's so much evidence at this point in social science research that shows that the people who have the happiest, longest, and healthiest lives are those who actually invest in their social wellness, in their relational capital, in how they create an emotional insurance policy for themselves by being close with others. And so to me, that's an incredible and integral part of well-being, is the social side of it.
Important. There is indeed a lot of social science and other research, but beyond that, it's, you started out at the very beginning of this with sort of a, if I understood you correctly, you know, the Richard Rohr, the whole transition, so to speak, a lot of it is around contribution as opposed to accomplishment. And contribution requires a sort of a sense of where we are in society, whether, you know, where we are in terms of social connections, however one defines family. And there are, you know, many, many different ways to define family, however one defines community. And that's indeed why I work with individuals, but also teams, organizations, and then what I like to call sort of chance encounters, which is groups of people who would have no reason to come together, who find themselves coming together. And it might be for a week, it might be for an hour, it might be, and it might end up being for a lifetime. But it's quite interesting. And we certainly see that in things like the Blue Zones, where we look at, you know, parts of Japan or parts of Italy or parts of some of these countries. People are planting in their garden at a certain age, well beyond midlife, by the way. I mean, many of these people are in their 80s and 90s, and it's wonderful to see. But their primary priority It's the wine, but it's also sharing the glass of wine with friends. It's the gardening, it's gardening with friends. So I find that really interesting.
Dan Buettner, who popularized Blue Zones, is on our faculty. So he teaches here with us.
I mean, I think that whole concept is really interesting. I wouldn't want people to think that they have to live in a place like that, or they have to drink a particular kind of red wine or eat a particular kind of pasta or not, in order to, you know, have a long, healthy life. So I take those things with, you know, I think it's quite fantastic what he's done. I'm also on a bit of a personal anti-guilt campaign, where I feel like as a society, we've told people you can't eat sugar, you can't do this, you can't do that. And if you, you know, and if you violate any of these many, many rules, it's your fault if something happens. And that's another thing around midlife, because sometimes things start to happen around midlife. And I personally am not terribly interested in people being blamed, you know, blaming themselves or focusing on the blame.
So don't take it with a grain of salt. Take it with a bushel full of salt.
I want to come back to the age question, because I love the way you describe transition from ego to soul. And I'm wondering if you had to look at sort of your, you know, go back to Stanford again, where I have a number of students, obviously every year in different types of ethics focused classes, but very edgy classes. What would you say to them about what they should be doing, thinking about, focusing on, not focusing on, in order to be in a good place when they hit that 45 to 50 really difficult stretch, or 45 to 55 really difficult stretch?
I would say the more conscious you are about your shadow side, you know, to use the Carl Jung perspective, the more you will have some control over it. And so, you know, here are a series of statements. I am what I do. I am what I own. I am what others say about me. I am what I control. I am how I look. I am my brain. You know, come up with a bunch of different statements like that. This is something we do at MEA.
Right.
And stack rank them of how much that I am statement has dominated your life to this point. And once you sort of identify, let's say, what's number one, for me, it would be I am what I do. Once I have identified that, then I have to start to say, okay, how do I start to reverse engineer backwards from that, such that if I don't want to be that, I don't want to be defined by my business card in the future, what are the things I need to do? And so again, this is what MEA's program is about. This is what my new book, Learning to Love Midlife, is about. And what a lot of it does come down to is realizing underneath that I am what I do, what is the problem it's solving for? And for me, it was self-esteem. It was a sense of my accomplishments would give me a sense like you're going to like me. Because as someone who is a closeted gay kid who was an All-American athlete and in a fraternity, student body president, et cetera, like I was freaked out that like by coming out all after having had a lot of people like me, no one's going to like me. So I had to go out and work at you liking me by accomplishing things. Once I had a sense of like, okay, that I could like, okay, well, this comes down to social comparison and do people like me? And there's a lot of reasons why people like you. I mean, like this is where a coach or a therapist or a program like MEA can be helpful, because you realize like the only way people like me it's not like my accomplishments are the only way someone's going to like me. People are going to like me because I'm a good person. They're going to like me because I compliment them. They're going to like me because I have a positive attitude. They're going to like me because I'm reliable. They're going to like me because I'm a role model for resilience. There's a lot of ways for people to like you, Chip. It doesn't have to just be, you know, being a superstar, the hero around accomplishments. And then like, what is it about me wanting people to like me? And that's where you get really into the soul question, where you start to move beyond the ego. But like initially, the conversation you're going to have with yourself around this is going to be, you know, sort of like, okay, let's replace this thing I have to do with something else. But then you have to realize, okay, but you've just actually, as you said earlier in this conversation, like, did you just substitute one identity for another? You have to look at the underlying stuff. And that's part of what we do at MEA. And And frankly, that is what midlife's about. Mary Catherine Bateson came up with the term midlife atrium. And the midlife atrium is the time in your life where you have the space to reflect upon how you want to consciously curate the rest of your life and what pattern recognition you have about yourself to be able to say, okay, I know I can laugh at my ego on this one. Mm-hmm. And then you learn to move on. And it's quite freeing when you can do that.
Well, there are a number of things that I think are really important to emphasize in what you said. And I think they're good learning for any age. I mean, one of them is when you ask these kinds of really important questions, what is it that you're solving for? Right. And certainly any of us, I mean, my hand up first, those questions are triggering for me also. Right. Yeah. But think about when we ask young people, think about the statistics for the epidemics of mental health problems among young people today.
Yeah.
And think about the way we determine the quote value of a young person. Think about a college application. It's demonstrate your brain. It's demonstrate your accomplishments. It's demonstrate whether other people like you because you have to get recommendations and you have to demonstrate through what's on your CV. So I don't remember your other couple of questions, I must admit, but it's all of that. It's all of your triggering questions are basically what society is saying. This is what's going to get you to the next step, right? Yeah. And it isn't just there. It's then you want to go off and get a job. So I think what you hit upon is incredibly important. But I think there's also one more value that comes into play. And please tell me if you disagree. And this comes back to sort of, I'm not even sure you would qualify me as midlife anymore.
No, you're definitely midlife. Midlife is 35 to 75.
Okay, good. Okay, so I have a little bit of margin. At this point, midlife is looking very good. But this question of, okay, I want to peel off this reliance on showing my accomplishments, on showing my brain, on recognizing that who I am is not all of these things. I mean, that's a big, as you say, chrysalis, that's a big transformation point. And it really does require, as you say, sort of laughing at your ego. Are there things you do at MEA to help people along that path? And when are there people who just kind of don't go along the path? And what are the stumbling blocks people typically face?
Some of the stumbling blocks are people having to not being able to move from, as Connie Zweig calls it, from role to soul. So you're so attached to your roles and identities. You are so in the mix of the spinning plates that you're trying to keep not from falling, that you really don't have the space for curiosity or reflection or truly making a transition in your life. And there are a lot of people who have that profile, and they use their busyness as their way of deflecting, doing that work that would actually allow for the change to happen. Additionally, there are people who are fearful of making the change because they live in a world where people will not want them to change. You know, if you're a caregiver and you get a lot of, and that's your archetype, and you're the caregiver who's always giving to everybody else and not to yourself, and you're going to say, like, you know what? I'm going to dilute that. I'm going to be 50% of that caregiver. I'm not going away from it completely, but I'm going to, there's going to be people who will be pissed off because you're no longer serving them. So a lot of what people need, and this is why a residential retreat, going to a place for 5 nights, in not as a commuter, like, you know, we looked at having an MEA campus in Sonoma, which is not too far from San Francisco. It's like, okay, but that becomes a commuter campus then. No, we are in Baja and we're in Santa Fe, New Mexico. These are not two places that are there. It's a bit of a pilgrimage to come visit us. And that's partly because it allows you to break out of your habits and the mindsets that have been defining. So that's one of the first things we do in the first 24 hours is help people to ask themselves, what are the mindsets that are confining you in your prison? How might you actually go through a collective ritual that we do, which I won't describe because I want to, you know, we keep it quiet. But it's like, you know, it's a collective ritual that is really powerful. It's very safe. It's like no one's walking on coals or anything like that.
I was going to say.
No, nothing like that.
Get that reference.
No. But people are ready to let go in front of others the things that aren't serving them anymore. And within the first 24 hours, we identify what those are. And then you have 4 more days, because it's a 5-night program, to really dive into, like, okay, how will you do that? How will you let go of that? And what are you replacing it with? And that's the key, is it's, if you just strip a person bare of the thing that they've been so used to, they'll go back to it pretty quickly if you actually haven't started developing some practices and habits that are going to help move them in a direction that is their new true north.
This question of what are you solving for? I mean, that's a bit of a dig, right? I mean, that's a bit of a drill down and figure out what purpose, you use the word purpose, what purpose is it serving that I identify myself based on accomplishments, or that somehow my brain is the primary source of identity, or all the other incredibly interesting questions that you asked. So understanding what you're solving for, and it must be very interesting to understand whether what people are solving for in middle age, you know, in midlife, is the same as what they might have been solving for all along. And but all of this is incredibly fascinating, and all of this comes back in different ways to my sort of ethics infused ears, and I should say non-judgmental ethics infused ears, that true north, some sense of what are one's values, who is somebody without the brain, without the accomplishments, without what people say about them, how do they make decisions without any of that, strikes me as incredibly important. And again, at this point, let me end, because I know your book is going to be incredibly successful. And let me end by asking you to talk a little bit about your forthcoming book, which I'll look forward to reading.
It's called Learning to Love Midlife. But the subtitle is what gives you the hint of what it's about. It's, the subtitle is 12 Reasons Why Life Gets Better with Age. So we are surrounded by anti-aging messages. That's what society is really good at. And so this is a pro-aging book and helps us to understand that, yes, there's certain things that don't get better with age. And we're very familiar with what those are. But there's a bunch of things that do get better with age, not just based upon anecdotal evidence, but based upon social science. You know, our emotional intelligence, our wisdom, our emotional moderation, our spiritual curiosity, our desire and ability to have strong relationships. There's a lot of things, our holistic thinking, our brain, certain parts of our brain, certain types of brain behavior gets better with age up until our 70s and mid to late 70s. So crystallized intelligence versus fluid intelligence. So the book is both a personal deep dive into my own sense of how am I getting better with age? How have I seen and witnessed it here at MEA? And then what's the social science that backs this up?
Sounds fantastic. I don't know how anybody, especially within this pretty large category that you're describing as midlife, I mean, 35 to 75, it's pretty hard to resist a book that tells us we're going to get better. So yes. I'm very, very much looking forward to reading it, very much looking forward to exploring further MEA. As we wind up, anything you'd like to say that I haven't given you a chance to say, or anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that I have a daily blog, which is called Wisdom Well, and it's on the MEA website. MEAwisdom.com is the URL. But yeah, that's about it.
Well, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure to get to know you, Chip, and to get to know your way of thinking and your personal journey, and also MEA. So really appreciate your being here.